Pomone Broadcast Center. This is Take 2. May Martinez. A tentative deal's in place to end the LA teacher strike. It still needs to be ratified by union members, but we'll hear what's happened with some of the biggest sticking points, such as class sizes and full-time nurses in schools. Plus, lining up the Oscar nominations, the favorites, long shot surprises. Oh, and still no host for the show, by the way. That and a lot more coming up when Take 2 kicks off in just a few. Keep your ears here.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Pepperdine's Graduate School of Education and Psychology, offering an online hybrid doctorate of education in organizational leadership on campus in West LA, with attendance only twice per term. GSEP.pepperdine.edu.
From 89.3 KPCC, this is Take 2. I mean, Martinez, good afternoon to you. That's right, afternoon. It's our first day at our new time, and we are thrilled to have you along. If you need to remember it, just think this. Take 2 at 2. Take 2 at 2. All right, coming up, Oscar noms are out, and one popular streaming service is leading the pack with 15. That's right, 15 nominations. We'll have all the details. First, though.
Everywhere we go.
The latest on the LA teacher strike. That was the sound outside of Luther Burbank Middle School in Highland Park this morning before an announcement that LAUSD and UTLA had reached a tentative deal. Earlier, we stopped by the demonstration to hear what was on the minds of teachers, parents, and even students occupying the front of the school. It was brisk out. Many wore padded coats as they waved signs and chanted. At a table nearby, hot coffee and boxes of donuts were piled high. On the streets, drivers honked in support. Truckers, buses, commuters. There, in front of the school, I met U.S. history teacher Gustavo Lopez.
Well, first off, we're in the second week of this. How are you holding up?
Trying to keep our spirits up. As a middle school teacher, you have to hold up through difficult times. And this is no different than any other challenging moment, except that it's also a financial burden upon my family. My wife and I are expecting our first child, and we're digging into our savings.
Teachers are going without pay during the strike, but they've got a lot of support from parents. Here's Lula Cummings. She's the union chair for Luther Burbank Middle School and also a special ed teacher.
I mean, we're all scared and making that sacrifice. The only thing I've told our teachers is to just stay together and use one another for strength. And our community has been bringing us food. We've gotten gas cards. We've gotten quarters for laundry.
Jennifer Carter is one of those supportive parents. She was on the picket line this morning.
Now, where is your child? Is he in school or is he out here with you?
She's here with me.
She's here with you?
Yeah.
So what have you told her about why she should be out here with you?
Well, we talk about the quality of education. It's public education, and we chose to stay in public schools and not in charter and private schools. And we told her that it's important to really support a good quality of education. Some of that, or most of that, is smaller class sizes and having the resources you need.
Her daughter, Rosalind Carter Palacios, chimed in. The sixth grader said resources are sometimes scarce.
I feel bad for the teachers because they kind of have to pay for everything. I went to a class and our teacher told us that we have to be careful with the supplies because she bought them herself.
Now, with a tentative deal in the works that pay for more staffing and reduce class size, teachers like Adalid Sanchez look to the future.
I'm planning on addressing, you know, any questions my students may have, but at the same time, bringing back that sense of unity, that sense of safety in the classroom, that sense of belonging that we try to give our students, because ultimately, we want students to just feel like school is a respite from anything else in their lives and go back to academics and really go back to preparing students for the future.
Lula Cummings adds that while it's been a trying 6 days, it has been worth it.
When this is over, would there be a sense of victory that you'd feel?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, our community has reached a whole new level and meaning of community. The teachers and staff at the school that are out, our librarian, our nurse, our social worker, our counselors, our relationships have changed because of this action. And I think that everything that we've done so far, I believe in. It's been the right thing to do. And if it turns out that the tentative agreement is not something that we like, then we stay here and we keep going and we keep fighting.
All right, now to that tentative deal reached between the Los Angeles Unified School District and the union that represents its teachers. Here's LA Mayor Eric Garcetti earlier today.
It is a historic agreement. It gets to lower class sizes. It gets to proper support staff, to community-based schools, to special ed, adult ed, to expanded green space, and the list goes on.
For more, we turn to Kyle Stokes, KPCC's education reporter. He's been all over this story for weeks. Hello, Kyle.
Hello, Abe.
All right. Eric Garcetti called this tentative agreement historic, but the specific details are only just coming out. What can you tell us about the deal when it comes to salary and extra staffing?
Okay, so first of all, the salary deal is basically what the district has had on the table for some time now. A 6% increase for teachers. That includes 3% increase retroactive to July of 2017, and then another 3% that's retroactive to the beginning of this school year, 2018-19. So that's the salary piece. It looks a lot like what the district had on offer previously. On staffing, we had been looking at a one-year agreement for just basically the next school year. What the district did is expand it out to cover the next 3 years. So we've got a bunch of different items now that are being kind of phased in over multiple years, which gives the district more time to find the funding for how to pay for it. So for instance, instead of getting 176 nurses for elementary schools just in this coming year, the district will roll out a slightly smaller number of nurses in the coming school year, just 150, so just about a dozen less, then another 150 next year, and then another 300 plus in 2021-22. So the potential to have a nurse at every school campus coming by 2022 if the district can find the funding for it. Similar increases in the number of librarians and also some more counselors in secondary schools coming in the next 2 years. And because it's spread out over the next 2 years, the aggregate number of additional staffing is going to be a little bit bigger on all of those counts, nurses, librarians, and counselors.
Now, what about one of the biggest issues on the table? That's class sizes, what they agree on.
Yes, class sizes. All right. Big point number one, the district got rid of Section 1.5. That means a lot to the teachers who are listening right now. To those of you who don't know, Section 1.5 is what's been described as the safety valve in the contract that allows the school district to raise class sizes essentially whenever it wants in order to save money. The district has had broad discretion to do this in the past. They have given up that provision. They did it basically no questions asked. There is basically now an understanding, though, that the union has an obligation to come to the district if there is a fiscal crisis and negotiate with LAUSD to raise class sizes to prevent future cuts. Now, that was one big sticking point. The second was just how much smaller to make LAUSD classes. What we are going to have happen is that there's going to be one student removed across the board from the current class size levels in the next school year, the year after that, another student, and then the year after that, and 2021-22, two more students. So an aggregate of four students smaller by the third year from now. And then in the year after that, there will even be further reductions, and the class size levels will go down to the highly ambitious class size levels that are in the current, what this is going to be confusing, but the current contract not adhered to because of this safety valve provision. So big reductions in class sizes, but again, phased in over 4 years.
Really quick, Kyle, you mentioned financial crisis. It might be too early to know what that is, but any clarification on what that is, what that would be?
Well, so it's $175 million is what the total cost of this is. And a lot of what the discussion is today, and by the way, $228 million for just the school year 2021-22. So a lot of money here. A lot of the discussion today was about finding extra revenue. Okay. And that's what the two sides are going to have to do, including potentially the increasing of a parcel tax. What I understand from district sources right now is that some of those class size reductions are contingent on finding new revenue, including through the passing of some local revenue generating measure like a parcel tax.
Hey, Kyle, just a few seconds left here, and we're still just getting all these details as they're coming in. What happens next in terms of process?
Well, so the teachers vote. That's likely to be wrapping up today. I'm not exactly sure the timing on that, but it should be wrapping up today. The school board is supposed to vote on this deal as well. That's not clear when that's going to happen. Should be soon, but the district needs to put together a formal proposal and agendize it. And it's public meetings laws is essentially the hang up there. There's also going to be oversight from the county on this deal.
And are they back in class tomorrow, teachers?
They should be back in class, okay, assuming that the tentative agreement is approved by the members.
KPCC's Kyle Stokes. Kyle, thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
To homelessness now. Starting tonight, thousands of volunteers will try to count how many homeless people are living in Southern California. Now, getting an exact number is almost impossible, but organizers of the massive effort have some expert helpers, people who are homeless or used to be. KPCC's housing reporter Matt Tinoco reports.
Brian Secro is 23. He lives in Hollywood, and most nights, he sleeps in a tent on the sidewalk.
We're people here. We exist. It's not like we're invisible, even though people would like to walk past and act like we're not even there.
He's also one of the many homeless people recruited for this year's homeless count.
You're not counting everybody, which they want to count everybody, but it's hard.
Shantytowns are by now visible most everywhere in Southern California, but thousands more people live incognito. They hide in the rivers, the mountains, the freeways, and the trunks of their own cars, and unless you know where to look, you would have no idea where to find them.
That's why they've enlisted certain homeless people to show them where people live.
Like Ryan, their experience of actually having had to shelter themselves means they know where to look. The more of them counting, the closer we get to actually knowing how many homeless people there really are.
It is possible, but it's just hard because how many people are here.
Which means
it's a guesstimation, and that's all it is.
R.D. Plashier is a formerly homeless woman who's participated in almost every count since 2010. As hard as organizers work to ensure the count is comprehensive, and it is, there will always be people they miss. Like when RD was homeless, she spent many of her nights just riding the bus.
3 a.m. in the morning, getting off a bus in Los Angeles, getting on the same bus to go back to Santa Monica.
Homeless people in metro train stations, they get counted. But the buses?
You are not going to get counted if you are on the bus.
Spots like these fall through the cracks mostly because of logistics and limited resources. Then there are some no-go zones for counters, mostly for safety. Like vacant buildings. They've never been counted since the annual census began in 2004. Still, RG participates because she knows how to search better than other volunteers who haven't ever slept rough. The number where she walks will be more accurate than if she wasn't out there.
I am the one who points out where to find the people because they will walk by them. And I say, yo, folks, we need to stop here. There's criteria that you need to mark on your sheets.
She told me how that played out in the last census, when she was walking with other volunteers and she saw a sleeping space hidden in the bushes of a church parking lot.
And I pointed down and they went, oh my God, we didn't see that. And I said, and we need to move because we are too close. We are impinging upon this person's space, and they know we are here. We need to move now.
Counters don't actually engage with people on the street. There's not enough time, and people's privacy is to be respected. But counting still involves searching out homelessness and studying firsthand how our poorest neighbors live. Last year's count estimated that, on any given night in Los Angeles County, about 53,000 people are homeless.
It's daunting.
That's Clementina Verhan. She's an LA Homeless Services Authority veteran and the chief organizer of the massive count operation.
At a minimum, we need 8,000 volunteers. And last year, we were able to get 8,500.
So many people are needed because the amount of ground to cover is so great. The count happens over 3 nights, and volunteers walk and drive precincts in teams, noting the people and the makeshift living quarters they see along the way.
We really want to be able to get new individuals that have not participated in the past.
Besides valuable feedback from the data, Verhan says the count is a starting point for people who want to learn more about homelessness in their community.
It's an eye-opener to realize where people are actually staying in order to survive out on the streets.
R.D. Plashier agrees. She counts to ensure the numbers are as accurate as they can be, but also because it's a chance for people who aren't homeless to learn.
It is important to spread even a small ripple effect to standardly housed people so that they understand what homelessness is and why.
Results will be available in a few months. Covering housing and homelessness, I'm Matt Tinoco.
If you want to help count, there's still time to sign up. Here's the website, theycountwillyou.org. The count is tonight, tomorrow, and Thursday night in LA County. The homeless count is also underway in Ventura County. About 20 minutes, we'll check in on how things are going on in Thousand Oaks, so keep your ears right here. All right, still no host for the Academy Awards, about a month to go before the big show. However, Oscar nominations are out. Now, just because no one's won anything yet, that doesn't mean there aren't winners and losers already. Coming up, frontrunners, underdogs, surprises, and how streaming services have changed the Oscar game. That's ahead when Take Two continues in about 60 seconds. Stay with us.
Southern California, the home of Hollywood, Dodgers, Disneyland. Sometimes it feels like paradise. But any second now, that could change. Because a big earthquake is coming.
This will happen. There's no likelihood of it not happening. We are not stopping plate tectonics.
When the earthquake hits, our world will be shaken. So what can you do to prepare? I'm Jacob Margolis, host of KPCC's new podcast, The Big One, your survival guide. Listen in Apple Podcasts.
Back now with Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm A. Martinez. The nominations for the 91st Academy Awards came out today, with Netflix at the front of the pack. It's the first time a streaming service has secured 15 nominations, including Best Picture. Now, to find out what this means for the future of the Oscars, we have the host of KPCC's The Frame, John Horn. Hello, John.
Good afternoon, I can say, for the first time.
I know, afternoon, that's right. And also The Hollywood Reporter's Rebecca Keegan. Hello, Rebecca. Hello, Rebecca. You there?
Hi there.
Hey, Rebecca. All right. So we get this band together once a year. I wish we just would do it more often, but it is Oscar time. So that's when we do kind of grab our instruments and play. All right. So let's start with you, John. Netflix spent a lot of money on marketing and campaigning. It looks like it paid off. Is a streaming service with this many nominations a turning point for the Oscars?
It could be. I mean, I think one of the things you have to put in context, it had 15 nominations today, which had matched its entire take in Oscar nominations in the previous 4 years. Now, 10 of those nominations went for Roma, and three of them went to The Ballad of Buster Scruggs.
It all adds up.
And two were for documentary shorts. But if you look at their business plan, I mean, their business plan is to spend, I won't use the word, a ton of money producing, acquiring, distributing, and marketing content. And part of that model is to get content that's really good, that people want to watch. And Roma fits into that. Now, whether or not Roma is ever going to make any money for Netflix is a hard calculation to figure out. But it makes Netflix look like a studio that filmmakers will want to work with. If you're a cineast who likes good movies, you say, wow, they got the Oscar nomination for this film. Even if I don't watch it, I might want to check out other stuff on Netflix. So I think in terms of posture, in terms of positioning, it's a huge day for Netflix. And to get the Best Picture nomination, its first, is huge.
John, when the nominations were coming down, I saw Roma as a Best Foreign Language Film, a nomination for that. I thought, okay, that means it's going to stay there and it's not going to be in the Best Picture category, the overall picture. But it got both. It got nominated for both. Can it win both?
It's going to be tricky. I mean, I think that's one of the penalties of being a foreign language film. I mean, I think it's certain, and I would mark this on my ballot if the Oscars were tomorrow, that Roma will win the foreign language Oscar. The question is, will Academy voters look at their ballots and say, okay, I'm giving Roma the foreign language vote. What should I do in the Best Picture race? And I had early conversations with executives at Netflix saying that if Mexico chose Roma as its official selection, which it did, it would hurt its Best Picture chances. Mm. And this person said, that's what I'm afraid of as well. So I don't know. It's certainly one of the best movies of the year, and I can make an argument that it could win Best Picture. I just worry that Oscar voters will put it in that category as foreign language and take their vote for some other film in the Best Picture race.
Now, Rebecca, Roma has no reported box office grosses. Nominated for Best Picture. How is that possible?
Yeah, one of the things about Netflix that sort of irritates its studio competitors is that the company does not report box office grosses. It does something called four-walling, where it rents the theater out and sort of tallies the numbers itself. That's irritated a lot of people in town and not won Netflix a lot of fans among at least the executive branch of the Academy, which they are hoping will cast some votes for Roma.
It definitely got about, I'm adding up me and my wife. So it got about $60 from me and one other person. That's for sure. I can confirm that much because we went to go
well,
see it.
Well, maybe that's how we'll do the box office grosses. Yeah. We should all just ask everyone we
the
know.
The A. Martinez multiplier.
Add them up on my Texas Instruments calculator. Rebecca, all right, so what's next for Netflix now that nominations are out?
Right. Well, a big part of what Netflix is trying to do is to convince sort of the Hollywood establishment that they are here to stay and that they belong as part of that establishment. And one move toward that end is they're attempting to join the Motion Picture Association of America. It was revealed this morning. That's the Hollywood trade group that the six major studios belong to. And they do have a lot of issues in common with Netflix, whether it's concern about privacy or tax credits for film and TV productions. So there's a lot that they're aligned on. And there's a lot of reasons why Netflix would want to be part of this group. And they would also bring some serious money to the group, which the MPAA will need when Disney and Fox become one studio very shortly.
Would that, John, help kind of knight Netflix as a legit studio, kind of put, you know, the sword on the shoulder kind of thing?
It would help, I guess, in a kind of figurative way. I think the more important organization that they want to be a part of is NATO, not the North Atlantic Trade Agreement. That is the National Association of Theater Owners, which does not like Netflix movies in its member theaters because Netflix releases its films on streaming sites and in theaters, or what tries to. At the same time, most theaters, most national chains won't book a Netflix movie. And I think that's a big issue. It's the way in which movies are perceived. Yes, you can see Roma on Netflix. It's such a better experience in a movie theater. And the fact that most theaters won't show it is a shame because it deserves to be seen in a big theater. And that's not going to happen until Netflix either buys the theater chain or figures out how to make NATO, the National Association of Theater Owners, happy with its distribution model.
Talking Oscars with KPCC's host of the KPCC, The Frame, John Horn, and also the Hollywood Reporter's Rebecca Keegan. So, all right, let's talk about some other nominees.
Black Panther. Must feel good. Sitting here comfortable. What do you want? Your secrets. Your weapons. I'ma burn it all!
So, John Horn, I don't know if you know this. I'm a bit of a comic book movie nerd. I was surprised to see Black Panther nominated for Best Picture, a first film based on a comic book to earn that distinction. What do you think? You think the anti-superhero bias is finally changing?
Well, I wouldn't say there's an anti-superhero
bias.
I would say there's an anti-bad movie bias,
and there's
lots of movies. I'm not going to single all of them out. Some of them involve Superman.
Don't bring up Green Lantern. Don't bring up Green Lantern.
I'm not going to mention the Avengers. Right. There are certain movies that are good, popular movies. They're not like the greatest achievement in cinema art, and I think that's part of why we had this conversation that was abandoned last year by the Academy about creating the most popular film Oscar. Black Panther is a very good movie in its own right, and it's obviously incredibly successful here and around the world, but it is a beautifully made movie. It's well acted. It's well written. It actually, I think, works on so many different levels, so you can't really say it's an outlier because it is a good film. And, you know, I think there are some films in the Best Picture race that a lot of people would say, well, really? That's in Best Picture race? Not a lot of people say, why is Black Panther there? A lot of people think it deserves to be there.
All right, so Rebecca, Netflix, we mentioned them with their 15 nominations. Disney had them beat, though, with a total of 17. So let's talk about Disney studio consolidation. Rebecca, what's going on with them?
Well, and by the way, as you guys were just talking, I got a press release in my inbox from the Motion Picture Association of America welcoming Netflix as a member. So no longer a deal being talked about, a done deal. Netflix is now part of that studio group as we're talking. And they are joining Disney, as you mentioned, which had a really good day in terms of Oscar nominations. And Disney, in so many ways in the movie business, is just the 800-pound gorilla in the room. It had about a quarter of the box office market share in 2018. And when it swallows up Fox and Fox Searchlight, it will become bigger, not only in terms of its box office, but clearly in terms of its sort of Oscar prowess. Fox Searchlight in particular being a company that's sort of their entire reason for being. If you combined all of those studios together, you'd have 37 nominations. That's what this Oscar nominations day could look like next year for the company that is Disney, Fox, and Fox Searchlight.
How do you think that could affect future Oscars, Rebecca?
Well, it's interesting to think about this, you know, the business is always changing. We've talked a lot about how Netflix is sort of forcing companies to adapt, and this is one sign of it, that you're seeing these major studios consolidate. Fortunately, there are new players, including Apple and Hulu and Amazon, who sort of increase the number of potential financiers of films at the table, and the sort of breadth of experiences that people are interested in making movies about. So we see the big old-fashioned studios sort of consolidating, just as we see these tech companies making inroads into both the industry and the Oscar business.
All right, now we mentioned Black Panther is in the running for Best Picture, but actually up until today, another film was a front runner. Tell me
something, girl. You write songs or anything?
I don't sing my own songs.
Why?
I just don't feel comfortable.
Here's what we're going to do. You come sing that song that I love.
No, I can't do that.
All you got to do is trust me.
Yeah, Lady Gaga, Bradley Cooper, A Star is Born. Now, Bradley Cooper directed the film, is nominated for Best Picture, no longer, though, considered a frontrunner. John, why not?
Well, it was not nominated for Best Director for Bradley Cooper. Now, that is not an immediate disqualifier, because there is the Academy has never been that fond of actors who direct. Ben Affleck comes to mind. The movie won Best Picture. Ben Affleck not nominated. But I think that is a big oversight. And there's a way to kind of do some tea leaf reading about the Academy Award nominations. Film editing is a key category, because if you're not nominated for film editing, you're not likely to win as Best Picture. And often you need to win the film editing prize to win Best Picture. And Star is Born is not in film editing, and it's not in the directing race at all.
Ryan Coogler directed Black Panther, but he was not nominated for director.
Yeah.
It's kind of a weird...
It is weird.
I don't know how to make it sense.
I think if you look at the films that they singled out, Yorgos Lanthimos, who directed The Favorite, which Fox Searchlight has with 10 nominations. I mean, I think that's very important. Adam McKay for Vice. Spike Lee for Black Klansman, his first nomination for directing. And then Pavel Pawlikowski for Cold War, Poland's foreign language film. I think that was really unexpected, but it's a really beautiful, difficult, but very moving and emotional film.
Now, original and adapted screenplay, John. What do those nominations mean for the overall
story? Well, I think you can look at that and say, you know, did they get this right? Were there any films that weren't included that should have been? I can make an argument that Eighth Grade was one of the best written movies of the year. It did not get adapted or original screenplay. Ballad of Buster Scruggs was one of the films that did surprisingly well. It had 3 nominations. It was in for adapted screenplay, but Black Panther wasn't. Leave No Trace wasn't. Eighth Grade was snubbed from the original screenplay race. Again, you can't fit every film. There were only 8 Best Picture nominees. The Academy could have done as many as 10, and they didn't. I didn't feel there were any great oversights there, but I'm sorry that Eighth Grade did not get more Oscar love.
Finally, let's talk about inclusion, Rebecca. How is this list being received?
Well, in many ways, this is a much more inclusive list of Oscar nominees than we've seen before. Some interesting newcomers. Hannah Beechler is the first African-American production designer. She's the production designer on Black Panther. Some acting nominees from underrepresented backgrounds, like Yalitza Aparicio, the indigenous Mexican actress who's in the lead of Roma, Mahershala Ali, Regina King. A directing category that is sort of racially and ethnically diverse, but doesn't include any women, which is sort of sadly common. One movie that was left out of the Oscar nominations was Crazy Rich Asians. That's a movie where many people felt the inclusion conversation was sort of helping to propel it along through awards season. So kind of a mixed bag, but certainly progress in many respects from the Oscar nominations of a few years ago.
John, coming up today on The Frame at 3:30, you'll talk to a film critic, Claudia Puig, about inclusion. So give us a preview. How are the Academy's new members maybe shaping some of these picks?
We're going to talk about the documentary feature race, because I think if you want to look really at an interesting category that says a lot about the Academy, you can look at the documentary feature race. The film that was not only presumed to be the leading nominee, but the likely winner, Won't You Be My Neighbor, a great film, I thought, by Morgan Neville about Fred Rogers, was not nominated. There's a movie about the free climber Alex Honnold called Free Soul that was. But then there's a very small, very personal documentary called Minding the Gap that was nominated for documentary feature. If you look at Fred Rogers being shut out and Minding the Gap being included, I think that says a lot about how the changing demographics of the Academy are changing the way that certain categories are looking right now.
And still no host for the award show. Anybody hearing anything about anything when it comes to that?
I think we could get, I don't know, what's The Rock Johnson? What's Dwayne Rock Johnson doing?
Doing?
I don't
know. Right, right.
I don't think anybody wants a job. It's a thankless job. You only get blamed. You don't get credit. They're going to go without a host, and let's see how it goes.
John Horn, host of KPCC's arts and entertainment show, The Frame. That's at 3:30 today. And Rebecca Keegan is with The Hollywood Reporter. Rebecca, John, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Earlier in the show, we heard about Los Angeles County's homeless count. Next, we go live to Ventura County. Now, they're going to be doing some of the same things in Ventura as they're doing in L.A., but getting an accurate count there can be challenging, stuff that people might not be thinking of. Find out what when Take Two continues. Stay with us.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Pepperdine's Graduate School of Education and Psychology, offering a master's in clinical psychology program with an MFT. Their flexible evening format has locations in West LA, Encino, and Irvine, and is designed for working professionals preparing graduates for licensure in both marriage and family therapy and professional clinical counseling. Classes start September. Apply by February 18th to be considered for a $3,000 scholarship opportunity at gsep.pepperdine.edu.
Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm A. Martinez. The tents and cardboard boxes lining city sidewalks are the most obvious indication that homelessness is a big problem in our area. As we heard earlier in today's show, LA County is now recruiting people who are or were homeless to help locate the many people living without roofs over their heads. Now we turn to Ventura County, which is also conducting its homeless count this week. Reporter Kaylee Wells spent some time on the count in Thousand Oaks this morning and joins us now. Kaylee, welcome.
Hi, A.
Now, tell us how the homeless count works in a place like Ventura County. Who does the counting and how do they go about doing it?
Sure. So today, all the different jurisdictions, they're doing their own counts and then sending them to the county. So I just stayed with the sheriff's deputies and the volunteers in the city of Thousand Oaks. So the volunteers were given designated streets to comb through in their cars and on foot. And then they asked questions about where the people they met were sleeping, if they had a job, if they were abusing any substances, and then they offered them some services based on their questions, but then they put those answers into an app and they're recorded for the county. But then I mostly just stayed with the deputies who were participating, but they were like knocking on cars, waking people up, and they were making more harrowing treks into encampments under overpasses, that kind of thing.
Under overpasses. Now, you've been counting homeless in Thousand Oaks, you mentioned that, which is the second largest city in Ventura County. Still, a lot of people would consider it kind of a suburban place, a suburban area. What does today's count reveal about the homeless situation there?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's more than you'd expect because Thousand Oaks, there's still two freeways that run through it. So there's a lot of bridges to stay under. There's a lot of brush where you can stay unseen. Honestly, we passed through places and deputies would stop because they have an eye for it, but I couldn't spot people until we got closer. HUD says it's something like 80 homeless people in TO, but when I said that number to one of the sheriff's deputies, he kind of scoffed and said it's more like 300 to 400 because that's not counting the people in hotels and cars or staying on people's couches.
Wow, that's a big difference between 80 and 300 to 400. Wow.
But now,
earlier we heard about how it's difficult to get an accurate count because of the homeless, since many of them live in places that volunteers might not think to look. Is this something you've personally encountered today? You mentioned how you didn't have an eye for it, but have you seen that?
Yes, totally, because a lot of the people that I met today are really resourceful. Like, there's this one section of brush near Del Taco. It's really popular because, yes, there's shelter. Yes, it's really hard to see you if you're living there, and it's near really cheap food. But also, like, with the population that sleeps in their cars, we saw maybe half a dozen cars parked in the 24-hour fitness parking lot early in the morning before sunrise. But by the time most of the world is awake, they've gone into that gym, taken a morning shower, and they're headed off to work. You wouldn't even know they're homeless.
Now, you were spending time with the sheriff's deputies this morning, and here's what one of them had to say.
Just talked to one guy. I just don't get it. He's living in his van. He works at TO Power Sports, and his dad lives in Thousand Oaks. Apparently, he's a retired deputy from Lost Hills.
Wow, retired deputy from Lost Hills. That says a lot, doesn't it, Kaylee?
It does, and honestly, the most surprising part, he hadn't met him, but a lot of the deputies knew a lot of the transient population already. They were going into parts of town because they knew a couple people lived there already. And yes, this is their job. They're vulnerable communities officers, but they could tell you a person's name, where their family lives, where they grew up, the mental and physical health issues they were dealing with, what they've been arrested for in the past. Is crazy.
So that, I mean, I would imagine that adds to the difficulty of getting people off the street.
Yeah, I mean, they say a lot of them are service resistant. They say they don't really want help they're being offered, or they hear shelters are scary, so they just want to stay where they are. They also, the deputies explained that, you know, okay, so you go and arrest someone, maybe they're not fit to stand trial, so it's deemed they need to go to a rehab center or somewhere that helps with mental health, but maybe that place is full. So then they're told you should have outpatient help instead, but maybe they don't really have the ability to go drive back and forth to wherever those services are.
Is it too early, Kaylee, to tell if homelessness is increasing or decreasing in Ventura?
The short answer is yes. So everybody sends in their numbers today, but the county doesn't finish crunching them until March. But we probably won't be seeing that final report until April.
All right. Kaylee Wells is a reporter who's been participating in today's Ventura County Homeless Count. Kaylee, thanks a lot.
Thanks, A.
All right, to books now. 6 years ago, Karen Thompson Walker took the fiction world by storm with her debut novel, The Age of Miracles. The New York Times bestseller tells a story of an 11-year-old girl whose coming of age is disrupted by a slowing of the Earth's rotation. Now Thompson is back with a new book that's considered one of the most anticipated of the year. Here she is to tell us more.
I'm Karen Thompson Walker. I'm the author of The Dreamers. So The Dreamers is the story of a mysterious sleeping sickness that's spreading through a small college town in California, a fictional town, and it begins on a freshman dorm floor, and it soon spreads out into the community. The main symptom is just that it puts people into this seemingly endless sleep, and eventually it becomes clear that some people are experiencing, while they're in this sleep state, some strange dreams. As a fiction writer, I like to write about the parts of human experience where the ordinary overlaps with the extraordinary. And so I think sleep, for all of us, it's, of course, profoundly familiar part of life. And yet it retains a kind of essential mystery. The kernel for this particular story, this part sometimes I feel like sounds too good to be true, but did come to me in a dream, which is I had a dream where everything was ordinary. I was in my bedroom. I was in my regular bed in the dream, but I couldn't wake up. That was the only thing that was strange. I kept trying to wake up and I couldn't wake up. I had already been working on a story about a strange sickness on a college dorm floor. But when I had that dream is when I decided to make the sickness a sleeping sickness. I began writing this book when I was living temporarily in Iowa City, which is a college town where the University of Iowa is. But being there reminded me of, you know, watching the undergraduates walk around and just thinking about how, what a weird time in life college is. And so it sent me remembering back to my own college experience, which was at UCLA, actually. There's just something so intense, especially about the freshman dorm floor. This book takes place in the first few weeks of freshman year. So, you know, having all these strangers packed together in a small space in the dorm, in a way, it is a kind of quarantine because you're forced so close together with people you don't know yet. And there's the possibility of intense bonding. But one of the main characters is this young woman named May, who's a freshman who in the first few weeks of college has not really connected with the other people on her floor. So she's feeling kind of isolated and apart. For me, you know, growing up in California, there is a feeling of risk, feeling of a kind of looming catastrophe, but also an incredible natural beauty. And I was interested in that overlap of this feeling of risk, but also beauty, and also the way that people, even though there are these kind of dramatic natural catastrophes that are always possible, you know, Californians carry on with our ordinary lives in the face of that. And I think I learned something about how to live with uncertainty by growing up in California. I tried to set the book initially in Iowa, but I found after I'd written about 50 pages or so, there's something about the California landscape, which is where I grew up. I'm from San Diego originally, and I set my first book, The Age of Miracles, in Southern California too. The story takes place in a town that I invented called Santa Laura, California. If you imagine the landscape near, say, Lake Arrowhead. But this is a different town that I invented. But, you know, there's a lake. It's in Southern California, and it's sort of up in the mountains, and it's wooded. But it's still not too far from L.A. There's something about the landscape that I just feel so inspired by and attached to. And I think it might be just the place where you grow up. I just think that you never know another place as well as the place where you grow up. There's something about my childhood in California that has stayed with me in a kind of tactile way. And so I love to write about it. You know, I remember what the air smells like, what fire season is like, what the Santa Ana wind feels like. And so I like to use that territory in my fiction.
It's the edge of the world in all of Western civilization. The sun may rise in the east, at least it's settled in a final location. It's understood that Hollywood sells California.
We may have reached a tentative deal to end the teacher strike here in Los Angeles, but the partial government shutdown continues. Now, the Senate is expected to vote on bills to reopen the government on Thursday. But in the meantime, federal workers are still going unpaid. If you are affected by this, send us your story on Facebook. You can find us at Take Two Show. All right, you got a newborn baby in your arms. What's one of the first things a mom is thinking about? Quite possibly on the top of the list is feeding the little one. There are a few options, but the most time-honored and natural one might not be the easiest one for you. Find out why when Take Two continues. Back now at Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm A. Martinez. All right, we close today with a story that many of you parents are familiar with. Feeding babies. Now, breast milk is considered the perfect food for our littlest humans. It's nutrient-rich and protects against illnesses. But it's not always easy to breastfeed an infant. And as KPCC's health reporter Michelle Faust-Raghavan found out, a lot of moms struggle with it for a variety of reasons. Now, this is the topic of the latest installment of Ladiest, our regular look at women's health. And to demonstrate the challenges, Michelle brings us this audio postcard from a breastfeeding clinic in Northeast L.A.
She's hungry.
Baby Celeste is 5 days old. Her mom, Myra Hernandez, who's 32 years old, has had a hard time breastfeeding.
At the hospital, when they were putting her on my boob, like, it would hurt. It hurt so bad.
Mom's milk came in slower than she'd expected, and the baby's having a hard time latching on. Hernandez never thought it would be this tough. Cindy Clapp leads the breastfeeding programs for WIC in L.A. and Orange counties. Clapp says Hernandez is not alone.
For every mom that we see who, you know, has this baby breastfeeding, there were probably many hours of practice and misunderstanding and tears that came before that as the mom and the baby were learning together how to make this happen.
Hernandez thought about giving up, but then went to one of the WIC breastfeeding clinics. There she met Jessica Lopez, a lactation specialist who taught her how to massage her hard and painful breasts.
Okay, so I'm going to help you. The massage is called therapeutic breast massage, and you're going to do it upwards, okay? Mm-hmm. Okay. This will help with making the breast softer, which will allow the flow to be faster as well, okay? I know you can't see this, but as I'm doing this, it's just flowing out.
Yeah, I can see.
You can see it? Mm-hmm. You can?
All right, now, small victory for one mother. Michelle joins me now in studio to talk about breastfeeding challenges, which is the subject of her latest, latest column. Hello, Michelle.
Hi.
All right, first, tell us more about what happened with Myra.
Well, Myra is a first-time mom. She was very frustrated with breastfeeding. She was dissatisfied with the lactation assistance that she got in the hospital, and she was starting to breastfeed a little. That day, I was able to watch her get a little bit of breastfeeding done there. She got some help and support, as we heard. Yeah. Then they were teaching her how to pump. She was learning how to get better efficiency in pumping. And also, she did have to bottle feed with formula a little bit, but she also got some help with the best techniques to do that. And they're helping her to breastfeed exclusively if she's able to get that done. And, you know, it sounded like she was very emotional the whole time I was there, and very grateful for the help that she was getting, because this was something that was challenging for her.
And stressful, I would imagine.
Right.
Yeah, for any new mom. So what do the experts recommend when it comes to breastfeeding?
Well, the American Academy of Pediatrics recommends breastfeeding exclusively for the first 6 months, and then breastfeeding after that up to 12 months with complementary foods as well. And that can continue after that for as long as mom and baby want to do it. And since most moms work, that can be a little bit hard for some people to maintain. Pumping breast milk and bottle feeding is the next best option for many women, although there are also some challenges with pumping.
Now, what did you hear from other women about their experiences with breastfeeding?
Well, I mean, breastfeeding is natural. You know, you mentioned that when you're introducing this whole segment, but it's not always 100% instinctual for every woman. We heard that with Myra Hernandez in this story. It's extremely healthy practice. It's good for mom. It is protective against certain cancers. It's good for the baby. But that doesn't mean that it's always easy for everyone. There are some women who do have an easy time with it, but more than 100 women responded to a query that we had out about breastfeeding. The vast majority of them had some trouble, especially in the early days. And that's why support is so important. Whether you can go to a clinic like this clinic that she was able to go to, or get help from a doula, a nurse, a friend, a lactation consultant. Those hardships, really, most women said they got over them, but only because of the help that they got.
Now, what sorts of trouble are women experiencing?
Pain. We heard that in her story. That is a sign that you need help, because lactation specialists remind women that breastfeeding should not hurt. That's a big reason why Myra came into this breastfeeding group. PHFE WIC, her consultant there, told her that it shouldn't hurt. And because she had heard that before she gave birth, she knew something wasn't right.
Wow.
Some babies have trouble latching. It can be because of the shape of the mom's breast. It could be something to do with the baby's mouth. There are different reasons why that happens. Too little milk, also too much milk, can be troublesome, you know. Infections in the ducts, mastitis. Some women experience a great deal of stress around breastfeeding, whether that's because they get a lot of pressure, or, you know, past sexual violence can be a reason why you may not feel comfortable breastfeeding. Some women wrote in to us about that they had a premature baby who had an illness and had to be separated from mom.
Wow.
And then when they came back from NICU, the baby didn't want to breastfeed, but the mom was still trying and doing all the things that they could. So a lot of things get in the way, and that's the reason why getting help is so important.
Michelle, how many women in California breastfeed?
That's pretty common. At least everyone is trying, like most people are trying at least. Nearly 9 in 10 women in California say they've breastfed at some point. That's according to the CDC. By the time a baby's 6 months old, 2 out of 3 women are still breastfeeding at least sometimes. Exclusively, that's 1 in 4. So that's a lot fewer. Remember, the American Academy of Pediatrics recommends at least up to 6 months. California Healthcare Foundation found that white women are the most likely to breastfeed exclusively. Rates are lower among other racial groups. And women with private insurance are 8% more likely to breastfeed exclusively than women on Medi-Cal. So there are some things that get in the way.
All right. Are women getting enough help on this, though? Because that seems to be like the key question here.
Right. Some women are. The ACA requires that women get help, but what form that takes can be different, and the types of hoops that you have to jump to get that can be also a problem. Most women reported to us that they're talking to someone. We mentioned those WIC services, but that's for women who qualify. If you don't qualify for that, then you may have to go to a private lactation consultant if your insurance doesn't cover that. It is very expensive, but there are free services like La Leche League. There are other women's groups similar to that, and online communities. A lot of women say that they've done that. But what the lactation consultants have told us is that getting help early and planning for breastfeeding supports during pregnancy is the best way to head that off.
That's Michelle Faust-Raghavan, KPCC's health reporter. And you can read Michelle's latest edition of Laist on our website. That's laist.com, laist.com. Check it out. And while you're at it, you can let Michelle know your questions about women's health. Michelle, thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right, remember, Take 2 at 2 o'clock each and every weekday. You can find us on Twitter at Take 2. See you tomorrow.